From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Speaking to reporters before meeting with his cabinet at the White House today, President Trump complained about being forced to abandon his plan to host the G7 summit at one of his resorts. And he was dismissive of a constitutional clause that forbids federal officeholders from accepting gifts from foreign states.
I don't think you people with this phony emoluments clause, and by the way, I would say that it's cost me anywhere from $2 to $5 billion to be president. And that's okay. Between what I lose and what I could have made, I would have made a fortune.
Also, former top diplomat to Ukraine, William Taylor, testifies to House investigators tomorrow. Meanwhile, White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney continues to walk back comments he made last week about a quid pro quo in Ukraine. There's plenty to discuss with NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. And Ron, let's discuss this cabinet meeting for a moment. Trump spoke negatively about the constitutional clause I mentioned. This, of course, comes at a pivotal time for the administration. Remind us quickly about this clause.
All it says is the president shouldn't be profiting from being president. He shouldn't have business deals going on that make him richer because he's the president of the United States. No emoluments. That's a word we don't usually use anymore. Mm-hmm. And the president apparently attacked this as, quote, the phony emoluments clause in the Constitution because he was unhappy that he had to pull back on his plans to have the G7 conference next year held at his own resort down in South Florida, the Doral. And this, he said, was the very best place to have it. And everyone was going to be the better for it. And he did it for the country. And now he had to pull back because he got a lot of criticism, including from many of his own Republicans.
Yeah, many of the Republicans as well. And we'll talk a little bit about that support. But I want to talk a little bit about the impeachment inquiry. A reminder for folks, William Taylor testifies tomorrow. He was the diplomat who texted Gordon Sondland the message, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign," which is in reference to the administration's alleged efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. How do House investigators and what do House investigators hope to learn from Taylor tomorrow?
First of all, they want to get his testimony on the record firsthand. Some of this has been coming to us secondhand, thirdhand. So they really want to get him describing this entire situation, which he has to know intimately and has certainly intimated that he does know and does have a lot to say about. Now, he is making clear that the president was looking for information about the Bidens, looking forward to 2020. The White House has recently been trying to make a distinction by saying 2020, 2016, we were really just looking into that missing server that the Democrats lost back in 2015, 2016. That's what we were trying to find in Ukraine. That's what we were asking them to look into. Nothing in the future. So they're going to want William Taylor to weigh in on that.
And there are other folks on that list as well that Democrats want to speak to. Who else could we hear from?
Phil Rieker from the State Department on Wednesday. He is the person with the portfolio for Ukraine, Russia, Eurasian affairs. Michael Duffy from the Office of Management and Budget on Wednesday as well. He has a similar portfolio in that agency. And finally, Laura Cooper from the Defense Department later in the week, possibly other people from the Pentagon. And they, too, are people who have expertise and have had responsibility for Ukrainian, Russian affairs, that part of the world. They should know a good deal about what U.S. policy has been there.
Yeah. Then there's Mick Mulvaney. He keeps saying things, then backpedaling on what he said. Last week, Mulvaney told reporters to get over it regarding political involvement in foreign affairs. He then tried to distance himself from those comments, and he was actually on Fox News on Sunday. How has Mulvaney's backpedaling been going over in Washington?
Not particularly well. He keeps getting himself into yet another contortion. The argument here seems to be that quid pro quo is some kind of magic incantation, like abracadabra, and that if you don't say the magic words, there's no crime,
yeah.
There's no problem. So look, quid pro quo is a lawyer's term for any arrangement where one action is conditioned on another action. You do this, I'll do that. And there is no necessity to say any magic words in Latin. What Mulvaney said last week was a textbook description of a quid pro quo. And he has tried to walk that back by saying he never said the magic words.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of people are wondering, will he be on the chopping block? Because we have seen it before. I guess time will tell. With the 20 seconds we have left with you, there's been lots of dissent between the White House and Republican members of Congress. Where do you think this will go from here? There are lots of people who are saying that they no longer are supporting him.
They are still supporting him with respect to impeachment. The president demanded that this morning, and I think probably at this point, most of them are going to stick.
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Tonya.
Well, in the UK, there is more Brexit uncertainty. House of Commons Speaker John Bercow today rejected Prime Minister Boris Johnson's request for another vote on his Brexit deal. Bercow said the request was basically the same as the one debated and decided on Saturday when lawmakers voted to delay approving Johnson's latest deal. Here's Bercow.
My ruling is, therefore, that the motion will not be debated today, as it would be repetitive and disorderly to do so.
The United Kingdom is scheduled to leave the European Union next Thursday, October 31st. I spoke earlier with BBC political correspondent Rob Watson and asked him what today's ruling from Speaker Bercow means for Brexit.
We know that everybody listening knows Boris Johnson reached this deal, never mind whether it's a good one or a bad one, with the EU last week. So now here's where we are. It seems to me we're going to find out there are two possible avenues between now and when Britain is supposed to leave the EU on the 31st of October. Either Mr. Johnson will, in the end, be able to find a small majority that is enabled to get his deal through Parliament, either on the 31st of October or with a longer technical extension, and Britain will leave the European Union. The other path is, the other avenue, the other possibility, it seems to me, is that the majority, any likely majority he has for a deal, is so small. And given the sort of the challenges and complexity of the law and the complexity and challenges of getting stuff through Parliament, as now the entire world has witnessed from the UK, the United States and beyond, there is the other path is that the whole process collapses and there has to be a general election during some extension to the Brexit process. It's those two things. I mean, he either gets his deal in the next couple of weeks or so, or the whole thing collapses and we have another general election.
But neither of those options includes a no-deal Brexit.
I would think that is unlikely. As I say, it's not impossible. But if you think about it, so Mr. Johnson is hoping he's either going to get his deal through Parliament, you know, between now and the next few, whatever it is, however many days is left, the 31st of October, possibly a technical extension. If that doesn't happen, one presumes that, you know, reluctantly, the European Union will grant an extension to the Brexit process because they don't want no deal. And then, of course, in the UK, we would have to have a general election.
Just bring us back to Saturday. They were calling it Super Saturday in the UK. There was supposed
to be. That's
what
my wife called it.
You probably had to work all day long. But there was a letter that had to be sent later on Saturday by Boris Johnson to the EU by law asking for an extension. And he sent the letter but didn't sign it and then sent another letter basically saying, I didn't mean what I said in the first letter.
That's right. And, you know, no one could say that we Brits have lost our sense of humor because I smiled that night because I then read something from an opposition Labour politician who said that there was a mystery third letter that Mr. Johnson had written saying, my name is Boris Johnson, I'm 5 years old and I've been very naughty. And I think even Mr. Johnson's supporters would either smile at that one. But serious, on a serious point with the EU, so I better answer that question. So the EU, they would dearly love Britain to just get this deal agreed to and get on with Brexit, and then we can all then they can get on with what it is that they want to do. But I suspect when push comes to shove, if Britain hasn't been able to do that by the 31st of October, and it may well be able to, I'm pretty sure the EU would grant an extension.
One more thing, Rob. There was a huge protest in London over the weekend, maybe hundreds of thousands of people saying that they want another vote by the people on the issue of Brexit.
That's right. I mean, and people have said it was probably around a million. It certainly seemed very, very large to me. So here's what I would say about that. That at the moment, I just don't think that the numbers are quite there in Parliament for there to be a vote for a second referendum. I think we're going to find out the answer to that in the next few days. But I don't think they're there yet. And so I think a second referendum would only come if the entire Brexit process collapses and there's a general election and then possibly a referendum. But here's a bigger point I would make about it. I think one of the reasons why the Brexiteers are in so much trouble, even if they get their Brexit, is that people on the Remain side, I think they're finding it very hard to accept the result of the referendum. I mean, Leavers would say because they're bad losers. But I think for this reason, that they feel that the deal that was reached by Mr. Johnson with the European Union, as they would see it, is so different to what was promised by Vote Leave in 2016. They said it would be easy, we'd keep all the same economic benefits, there would be no threats to the unity of the United Kingdom. I mean, Remainers feel that the distance, if you like, between what was said in 2016 by the very people now leading the UK government is so wide that they're not happy. And I think that will store up trouble for the Brexiteers in the months and years ahead.
That's the BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thank you, and we will see you next week in London.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
We will be broadcasting from the BBC next Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
The maker of big brands like Dove soap, Vaseline, and Ben & Jerry's ice cream is now making a bold pledge. Unilever, the third largest global consumer packaged goods company, says by 2025 it will cut in half its use of non-recycled or virgin plastics. It also pledges to collect and process more used plastic packaging than it sells over the next 6 years. This comes as the goods industry wrestles with the demands of consumers like you and me who are frustrated by throwaway packaging. The big question now, how will they do it? Joining us now as part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top is Richard Slater. He's Unilever's Chief Research and Development Officer. Richard, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, Richard, Unilever for several years now has marketed the issue of sustainability as an important value in the face of this climate crisis that we're dealing with. Your company relies heavily on commodities like palm oil, soybeans, and dairy. This idea of cutting plastics, it's really a big next step, and it's actually a very bold promise because we've all found how hard it is to reduce the number of plastics in our everyday lives. How do you plan to do it?
Yeah, well, the goals we've announced, you're right, they are ambitious and stretching. It's around using less plastic. Where we use plastic, we want it to be as recyclable as possible and also use recycled content and to collect and process more than our footprint. So it's going to involve innovation. It's going to involve new forms and formats. It's going to involve, I think, helping people make the right choice, making it easy for people around our labeling, offering great solutions for people that have less plastic in or even no plastic, and getting really creative and innovative. And that's what it's going to take. And that's part of the reason we've made the big announcements, actually, to spark that innovation and drive that internally, and also to stimulate the whole system of partners and the ecosystem outside as well.
Let's talk about that innovation in a little bit, but I really want to talk about how the everyday consumer will be impacted. What will this look like for the consumer? For instance, with the everyday products that we use, what are the differences and what are you asking people to do as you move through and offer these other options that don't rely so heavily on plastics?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think in for some of this, it involves very little change for people. So if you think of your Hellmann's mayonnaise, your Ben & Jerry's, your Love Beauty Planet products, or your seventh generation laundry product, the idea is to move as far as possible to 100% recycled content and to make these fully recyclable. So really there where people can make the right choice without really changing any behavior, and we're simply asking that where it's available, people then recycle. Then you go into, I think, the more innovative examples you were talking about. So in laundry, for example, using concentrates, where we have to get used to maybe buying a smaller pack on the shelf that lasts just as long. But in laundry, for example, in seventh generation, we've got concentrates coming to market that have half the water, 60% less plastic, 75% lighter. And so it's a little bit of a habit and behaviour change there to utilise that concentrated pack. And it could go right through to examples that I know you've talked about before, like Loop, where we we continue to own a pack, a very high-end, for example, aluminium deodorant pack or superb-looking skin cleansing product pack that could stay out proudly by the sink. And we pick up and provide regular refills to that with minimal to no plastic.
Yes, we actually featured that company on Here and Now. We featured Loop. It would eventually get consumers to use these refillable containers and then get refills delivered like the milk used to be. But is it going to cost more for the consumer?
Yeah, I think it's a great question because, you know, my philosophy with all of this is we need to make it really easy and seamless for people. So I think we've got to offer fantastic solutions that are convenient and are at the right price. Now, for Loop's a very specific example. It's early days and we're piloting it. If you bought a refill for a home care product or a laundry product, in theory, it can actually even be cheaper for people to use because effectively, not only are we getting those environmental benefits, it's actually cheaper to not have quite so much water, plastic and transport involved. So I think the onus is on us as consumer companies to innovate and come up with solutions that are great for people. It will, in some cases, need a bit of behaviour change and shift. But if we make it easy for people and bring people along, then I think we can affect the change.
One big battle environmentalists have been fighting is to change the strict regulations here in the United States over the packaging of foreign goods. Sometimes that requires a lot of plastic. How has your company and how will your company navigate this?
Yeah, in terms of in general around the sort of waste collection, processing and packaging in the US, it's a complex landscape today, actually. And as you know, it varies by state. It is something we're very active in terms of looking to influence the whole system, invest in recycling infrastructure, and also to work with regulators and government to make a difference here, you know, to put the right rules and regulations in that support recycling, use of materials, and not over-packaging. But it is a complex landscape, and we're working through that at the moment.
Mm-hmm. One other big part of this pledge is to collect back and process more of the used plastic packaging. How will your company actually reuse that plastic?
Yeah, we're also looking to halve our use of non-recycled or virgin plastic, as you said earlier. And so we're creating through that a large demand for recycled material. So we're looking to fix sort of or help improve both sides of the circle, if you like, or the system. So one is to create a lot of demand for recycled material. And then that helps the investment story and the business case for collectors and processors. Because one of the whole intents of this is to make sure that plastic isn't seen as a commodity that can just be thrown away and wasted effectively. It's plastic waste that's the issue here, not plastic. If we can keep plastic circular, then actually we keep the value in the system and we don't create that waste issue in the environment. So that's through partnerships and investments. And that will be in countries like the US, Europe, but also where the waste infrastructure isn't strong today. Some of the developing world markets like India, Indonesia, Southeast Asia.
Have you found any challenges with that? Because we know that China isn't taking recycled plastic anymore from the U.S. And we actually heard from an investigative reporter, Sharon Lerner from The Intercept. She talked with us about how very little of the recycled plastic in the U.S. is actually reused. Has it been a challenge for you in finding those partnerships with other countries as we learn more about recycling and just the sheer volume of plastic?
Yeah, I mean, we're always looking to partner and invest where it can make most difference on the ground. And we always aim to sort of buy and utilize our material locally wherever we can. So if you take the US, for example, Hellmann's mayonnaise moving to 100% recycled content, Ben & Jerry's, Love Beauty Planet, these examples are moving towards 100% recycled content, therefore creating a lot of local demand in the US for the material. And what we're actually seeing with our sort of commitments and others, and also with China's decisions and policies recently is there's actually investment going in into the US, into processing and waste collection. So although it's been a challenging situation, it's actually creating some positive investment and change in the whole system. And we're able to move our entire portfolio as Unilever to 50% recycled content by the end of this year, which is, you know, I think a major achievement and a big step along the way to plastic waste free.
Unilever is such a huge company, and I'm interested to know if you have heard or talked to other industry leaders about the use of plastics. I mentioned The Intercept's Sharon Lerner. She said the head of R&D at Pepsi Company told the plastics industry leaders at a conference that, quote, "We all hear that we have to get rid of plastics." Thinking about industry-wide, have you all talked about collaborations or coming together or even trading ideas on how to get through this?
Yeah, no, great question. One thing that I think we should be really clear on is that plastic waste is the issue, and that we're really committed to an environment free of plastic waste. We need to use then plastic responsibly, but you know, our goal is not elimination of plastics. If we can keep plastic mm-hmm. circular, then that's important. The important reason for that is if you simply take the simplistic view of trade-off with another material and replace all plastic with glass or metal, it's going to have adverse environmental impacts in other sources. So, you know, weight, transport, energy use, etc. So we have to take a balanced view. And if there are technologies that we can share or others can share that can make a difference, we should absolutely collaborate. So just recently on black plastic, for example, which historically has been very difficult to recycle, we co-invented a technology to allow that material to be recycled. That's in trials at the moment, and we'll share that with anybody out there to try and change the whole industry rather than simply changing Unilever. So for brands mm-hmm. like Tresemme and Axe to be able to recycle the packaging around those. So that's an example, and I think I agree with you. I really think that we should be collaborating as industry on this.
Richard Slater is Unilever's Chief Research and Development Officer. He is the man behind the company's recently announced pledge to halve its use of non-recycled plastics by 2025. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Financial markets have been weighed down lately with concerns about the trade war with China, the impeachment inquiry, Brexit. I could go on and on. It's a long list. But people who worry about these things tend to have two big questions. Is there a recession coming? And what should I do with my money? Jill Schlesinger is our business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. And she monitors these anxieties about the economy and joins us with some advice. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so you've been giving people financial advice for a long time. How spooked are folks right now compared to moments of uncertainty in the past?
You know, we go through these things, and I get it.
Yeah.
You know, every time there's a big move in the markets or a big headline, it starts to unnerve us. And the mm-hmm. real issue is because we are human beings, we want to do something with that anxiety. I would say that a couple of times this year, it's gotten to sort of a blinking red-ish feel, and that has just happened. Last week, when someone called my podcast, they said, "What should I do to prepare for Armageddon?" And I was like, okay, mm-hmm. if you're telling me that's happening, probably not call me.
Right, exactly. I know. So let's talk a little bit about some solutions. When people fear a recession, the instinct is, let me pull all of my money out of the market. But you say that's a fool's errand. Why?
You know, this is just some variation on the theme called timing the market. And what we have learned time and time again is that those folks who are trying to outguess or find the next move in the markets, they just never end up doing a great job. And the real reason why is that even if you're lucky enough to get the first part of the equation correct, let's say you were smart enough to sell in October of 2007, it's just nearly impossible to try to figure out when to get back in. So what we know is that over the long term, market timing just does not work. And anyone who says they can predict the top and the bottom is basically pulling your leg.
I'm actually thinking, though, about those at retirement age who may be thinking they just want to take all of their money out of their 401k. Is your advice different for those folks?
You know, I think that it doesn't have to be so much age-based, but it is, as you say, when you need the money. And I agree. I think that there are some folks who are saying to themselves, hey, wait a second. We're in this really long bull market. What, am I going to wait until the next bear market to make a move? Well, no, that's not the smart advice. But the right advice is to imagine this. I've got some money in my 401k or my IRA. I don't need all of that money the day I retire. In fact, my retirement is just the beginning of the next phase of my financial life. And that phase can last an awfully long time. You might retire when you're 67 years old and live 20 or 25 more years.
True.
So what we're really talking about is, do you have the appropriate amount of risk that you can really tolerate going into that period? And for those folks who are just carrying a whole bunch of risk right now, young or old, if you just feel like, wait a minute, this has gotten ahead of me, I need to make a change, that's okay, but stick to that allocation going forward. Don't second guess yourself.
Yeah, with less than 20 seconds, what's one smart money move that folks can also make right now given this uncertainty?
I would say just pay attention to the three big things in your financial life. Pay down consumer debt, including your student loans. Try to accelerate that. Build up that emergency reserve fund, 6 to 12 months of your living expenses, and take as much action as you can in contributing to your retirement.
Thank you.
I know
you,
it's
Jill.
Hard.
Yes.
A little bit at
yes,
a time.
Yes. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill and Rob.
President Trump said today that Democrats want to impeach him and they want to do it as quickly as possible. Right now, House Democrats haven't formally voted on impeachment. They've only started an impeachment inquiry, and there are big political stakes for both parties. Joining us now is a Democrat who lost her Senate seat last year in North Dakota to a Republican who has been very supportive of President Trump, former Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, and first of all, do you think, looking at what's going on with the impeachment inquiry right now and looking forward, that there's any chance that the Democrats don't end up impeaching this president?
You know, I think that everybody has got kind of the cart before the horse. The investigations that are ongoing, there may be something that exonerates this president. There may be things that are told that would say that the president was not aware. However, what we've seen so far is incredibly troubling. And I think once we get to the public hearings, we're going to have a much better idea on exactly where this whole thing falls out. But I think that the Democrats have clearly coalesced around actually conducting the inquiry, which wasn't true a month and a half ago.
Well, and so give me a sense of what you're hearing from people in your home state of North Dakota. Do you think that there is any appetite for impeachment right now?
I think there's two groups. One, the president is getting picked on. He's our guy. And even people like Senator Cramer, who defend him repeatedly and exhaust all reason in defending him, they're still not defending him enough. And then there's a second group. I wish it would all go away. I'm so tired of hearing about it. And this, none of this is helpful in moving the country forward. And so I think there is a level of exhaustion in America. And I don't think it's just in rural America. I think it's across the board. People just want things to be more normal.
So it seems like what you're saying is your message to the Democrats would be don't move forward with impeachment based on that?
No, I think that the speaker absolutely has a point when she says, I wasn't looking for this. It was handed to me. It was basically driven by the president. They have a constitutional obligation to do their job of checks and balances. I'm just saying that they also have their obligation to make a very targeted and I think specific case for why this president should be removed at the ballot box. And one of the concerns that I have is that impeachment basically sucks the oxygen out of the room in making the case for why Democratic leadership would be better for this country.
Okay, so let's talk about 2020 and the Democratic primary that's going on. There's a new poll from Suffolk University and USA Today that shows former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Elizabeth Warren neck and neck in the early state of Iowa, Biden with 18%, Warren with 17%. What do you make of that?
I think that it's really dangerous to look at Iowa and just look at public opinion polls. You've got to look at what's happening on the ground and who's got the best organization. And by all counts, it's Elizabeth and Mayor Pete. And so I expect that what we're going to see is a mixed result out of Iowa, but we're also going to see a lot of candidates who thought they would do well there not doing well.
Well, does it concern you at all as somebody who represented a state that, as you've said, is further to the right than a lot of states in this country, North Dakota? Does it concern you that Elizabeth Warren, who is on the left wing of the Democratic Party, that she's doing as well as she is in the primary process so far?
Well, I mean, she's not breaking out. She's in competition with a whole lot of other people. And again, when you look at those numbers, both she and Biden are polling below 20%. And that's pretty remarkable. And so let's not overstate it. I think that she has a message. She's clear about why she's doing it. That's compelling to people because they are tired of people who will talk around issues and not address them directly. So I expect that what we're going to see will be a lot of people being more direct about their message. You saw it already with Senator Klobuchar and I think Mayor Pete moving forward. So there's a lot of time between now and the Iowa caucus.
Do you think, though, that Democrats and Republicans who say that Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders would not be able to win against President Trump, do you think that they're right?
No, I don't think they're right. I think that everybody needs to take a deep breath and realize that if this becomes about a major initiative like Medicare for All, then we've missed the message. And that's the danger. The danger is that this has to be a referendum on this president. And the frustrating part for me is when I listen to this argument about who's going to pay for healthcare, number one, it doesn't address how much healthcare we're buying that we're not getting good results from. But it also gets the president off the hook. He's in court right now saying, we're going to eliminate your protections on pre-existing conditions, and we're going to take away your Medicaid expansion, which has been critically important to rural health care. We need to make this about the president and his policies, not just the corruption and not just the crazy that comes out of the White House, but how he is hurting Americans every day with the policies that he's promoting.
But if it is a Warren or a Sanders that ends up getting the nomination, do you see them backing off of their Medicare for All plan to try to appeal to a general election electorate?
No, I don't. I mean, I think that they are true believers. We'll see what Elizabeth says today or in the next couple of days about how she's going to pay for this. But I think at the end of the day, they are who they are. That's what makes them compelling candidates. The question is, can they sell those policies? It's going to be up to them to sell those policies. And Bernie constantly reminded me, look at, you know, the majority of people in this country would love to be on Medicare if they could. My point is there's a fair number of those people who don't want to be on any government insurance. And so let's move ourselves forward in terms of the direction of universal coverage without doing dramatic things that are going to frighten people and take the focus away from what the president's doing, which is taking away health care from millions and millions of people in this country.
What do you make of what Warren and Sanders are saying about taxing the rich right now? They're talking about Elizabeth Warren, an ultra-millionaire tax. People would pay a 2% tax on every dollar they have over $50 million. Is that something you think makes sense for the party to get behind right now?
Well, I'll tell you, it's polls really high even among Republicans. You know, I'm a former tax commissioner from North Dakota, so I look at this kind of from how do you administer it. And I think you'll see that of the countries that have actually imposed wealth taxes, the majority of them have backed off because it didn't achieve the results that they had hoped. So my advice is, look, take a look at things within the current tax code that advantage very, very wealthy people. Things like the difference between earned and unearned income in terms of tax rates. There's a whole lot of things that you can be talking about that actually achieve, I think, a better result. But like I said, this is enormously popular, not just among Democrats and independents, but also among Republicans.
Senator, I want to ask you about one more thing, and it involves not Senator Warren or Senator Sanders, but Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who in the last debate many times reminded voters where he's from. Here he is.
Look, this is why people here in the Midwest are so frustrated with Washington in general. Let me tell you, though, how this looks from the industrial Midwest where I live. Because here in the industrial Midwest, definitely where I live.
Okay, so, Senator, I grew up in the Midwest, too, and it seemed a little like pandering when I heard that. But what did you think? Does it work to remind people that he's from the Midwest?
Well, I think Amy does the same thing. And it does, I think, suggest that there is a different perspective and a different point of view. I mean, it's not saying we're morally more capable or that we're better than the next person, but we do come with a different perspective if you grew up in the Midwest. And also, I think, a greater sense of the political challenges. And I think that's what he's saying. You know, he's from Indiana. I'm from North Dakota. We understand that Democrats used to win those states, but they won by being pragmatists and by not overpromising things they couldn't deliver. And so I think if you look at what his message really was, it wasn't one of superiority. It was one of, look, we're many ways more pragmatic than a lot of people are who live in places where it is deep blue.
Do you think that he could be a surprise winner in Iowa?
Yep, I do. You know, it was interesting. Nate Silver today said, look, everybody's ballyhooing this 13%, but he's been at 13% for a while. And again, in Iowa, I look at who has the ground game, who has the enthusiasm, who has people who are true believers, who are knocking doors, and I think he is surging.
That is Heidi Heitkamp, who's the former Democratic senator from North Dakota. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
A paper published today in the journal Current Biology identifies the world's loudest bird. It's the male white bellbird, and it woos its mate with ear-splitting, two-toned clanging. The Pulitzer Center sent reporter Dan Grossman to visit with one of the paper's authors in the Brazilian Amazon. Here's his story.
Oh, something good singing here. Listen up for a sec.
Under the cover of a high jungle canopy, in the heart of the Amazon, ornithologist Mario Cohn-Haft leads an evening birding session, expertly mimicking a few tunes from his repertoire of Amazonian songs. Most birds here are fiercely territorial, so when Cohn-Haft whistles a song from within a common potu's territory, it responds by repeating the cry, the avian equivalent of yelling, "No trespassing." On a research expedition 2 years ago, Cohn-Haft captured a rare male white bellbird for his collection at Brazil's National Institute of Amazonian Research. As you can guess from the name, the white bellbird, at least the male, is completely feathered in white. This one was nearly a foot long from bill to the tip of its tail. And beneath the feathers, Cohn-Haft saw something unusual.
I noticed that its stomach muscles were very different from most birds' stomach muscles. This bird had a six-pack.
The bird's abdomen was 5 times thicker than that of a normal bird.
Clearly had to be some kind of adaptation to making a really loud sound, presumably so you don't blow your guts out, you know, and so you don't get a hernia.
He wondered if he'd discovered the secret to the male white bellbird's weird metallic song. It's famously loud. But it wasn't the record holder as far as anyone knew. That superlative was thought to be the screaming piha, a species heard across the Amazon.
And the screaming piha is really sort of the signature sound of the Amazon rainforest. There was a study actually measuring the amplitude of a screaming piha, and the suggestion in this paper was that it may be the loudest bird in the world.
Cohn-Haft wrote his old friend Jeff Podos, a professor at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and described the white bellbird's big muscles. Podos is an expert on animal behavior and communication.
he sent me an email, said, hey, do you think this is potentially related to how loud these birds sing? And I figured, well, there probably is some sort of link there. But as far as we could tell, no one has actually tried to document how loud those birds actually sing. That seems like something that should be done.
But there was a problem.
It's actually not easy to record amplitude or loudness of animals in the field.
It's difficult because the amplitude of a sound depends on how far away you are from the source. And a bird's call appears louder or softer depending on which direction it's facing. The researchers packed up a kit with a precision audio recorder and a directional microphone. They drove 14 hours north from Conehaff's lab in the Amazonian city of Manaus. Then they hiked 2 days into the white bellbird's territory at 3,000 feet above sea level.
You have to picture, he sings from a perch at the very tops of the trees, this exposed bare branch.
The forest was quiet, absent confounding sounds that could interfere with the measurements. At times they were able to get within 100 feet of branch-top males singing. And they made recordings with these birds staring right at them.
He has a song type that we call type one. It goes, bong, bong. And he has this rare song type, type two, which is this very explosive bonk, bonk. He gives that only once in a while, except when the female shows up and lands on his branch. He switches 100% to type two.
The scientists could tell immediately that the more powerful type 2 song is much louder than that of the screaming peahaw.
It is 3 times louder than the screaming peahaw. It's the loudest bird recorded to date.
More ear-piercing than a jackhammer. Twice as loud as the bellow of the American bison. 4 times louder than a howler monkey. Poto says there's no particular scientific need to know what bird is loudest, but
when we're trying to appreciate nature, we want to understand the extremes. It's a great place to look at the limits of what nature can offer. It's the same basic idea as, you know, why are we so interested in how tall giraffes can be or how fast cheetahs can run?
Their finding, published in the latest issue of Current Biology, raises many new questions.
How is it that they can do this without going deaf? How is it that the females are able to withstand this? And are they putting themselves at a disadvantage? We just have no idea.
Conehaft and Podos are continuing to study the anatomy of the birds of the Amazon that they've captured. They plan to make more measurements and observations of white bellbirds in the wild. For Here and Now, I'm Daniel Grossman.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.